to the Watchmen podcast from the DC TV Podcast Network, your number one source for all things relating to HBO's limited series Watchmen. This is your host with the most, one of many hosts, Carolyn, and with me today as always are Wendy, Vanessa, and the lovely Tony. And today we're going to talk about one of the best episodes, I think. And I may have tweeted about this earlier at Carolyn's Geek Out, but pretty much most of this podcast is going to be devoted to Jean Smart.
Yes.
And Laurie Blake stanning. So let's kick it off, man.
So before we get into it, I did notice something of interest about the Clan outfit. His costume, which I didn't notice last week, and I only watched this week when watching the What Happened Last Week, it has the badge on it. And that only stood out to me this time because the PDpedia article about that was sent to his grandfather when he became the marshal, which, you know, may or may not been about being the marshal of the, you know, as yeah. a police marshal.
Was that his grandfather, though, or his father?
It was 1955, so it might have been his father. I don't know. It could have been his father or his grandfather, but it seemed like there was something hereditary here, except the previous marshal, in quotes, was the Elder Keen. The plot thickens. I'm sorry, this is all according to PDpedia. I went back to the first episode to look at the Clan guy there, and he was not wearing a badge. He was just wearing a patch. But that doesn't mean it's not the father or the grandfather, because he wouldn't have been marshal yet. But I thought that in lieu of the letter on PDpedia, that was very interesting what we learned about the Keens.
Mm-hmm. So congrats on calling it, I guess.
and the other thing about that is, and we'll get to this later when we talk about the Millennium Clock, I felt like the symbol on that letter was also strikingly similar to the top of the Millennium Clock. So next to the signature, next to Keen's signature at the bottom of the letter on PDpedia, there's that. So we're getting ahead of ourselves. We should probably go back and start the episode with that a sound that I remember quite fondly. But I don't know if you guys remember the noise that the phone made in the phone booth.
I never actually used a phone booth. I remember seeing them like everywhere. But it was one of those things where like, why would I spend money to use the phone? I'll just wait till I get home.
So when I went to Comic-Con, that phone booth was what they used for their activation. So they set up the phone booth, and you went into it, and they did a little video where they scanned you, because it was one of those 3D scanners that was disguised as a phone booth, and they turned you into Dr. Manhattan. But I thought initially that it was going to be the kind of thing that gave people powers, so I'm very interested in seeing how this is going to work.
So the phone booths, what we know about the phone booths so far is they were set up by Adrian's company after it had been purchased by Lady True, who I have a lot to say about Lady True. but it is interesting. It supposedly sends a message to Mars, although Dr. Manhattan never talks back. It might be part of this great, I mean, again, last week, and this may conflict with other theories we have, but last week we had the theory that, you know, Dr. Manhattan isn't on Mars, and this is just a big scam to make people believe. And I also thought it looked like a confessional.
That is an interesting thought.
So people go in there and talk to Dr. Manhattan and tell him their troubles, and he doesn't answer.
Yeah, he's the blue god.
And Laurie kind of mentions that too, but can we talk about how she doesn't know how to tell jokes?
But it was a setup for the punchline, but I don't know. I guess maybe that's it. Maybe the way she told it was just supposed to be weird, so that it was. I mean, it was. I got the whole point of the setup and everything, but like it wasn't funny, or it was like just awkward. I guess she was generally awkward the whole episode.
Were the comedian's jokes ever haha funny? They were more like.
Right, that's what I'm saying. Like, I think they were not. I don't think he was very funny either. He was more dry, dark humor.
She definitely did that. Oh my god, she definitely did that. I'm so excited.
I did love that. Sorry, so where were we? We're in the phone booth.
And she's trying to talk to him.
I guess, and then should we, like, is there like significance in the bricklayer's daughter? Is it like a parallel to something, or?
Oh, I think it's obviously her in the community. That was my thought, and then she kind of confirms it later on.
Mm-hmm.
Does anybody else have a different theory?
I think it was also paralleling, her life with growing up and being kind of shoved into the crime fighter thing, but also the watchmaker son too. Like, it's like this reverberating theme of legacy and like people's, you know, things keep getting put passed on or whatever. So I kind of caught that as well.
Oh my goodness! So the watchmaker, it was about the pieces being thrown to the wind. And here it was the daughter, not the father, throwing the pieces to
him. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought it might have been a parallel to something, too, because the brick was really weird, you know? I can't recall it just seemed like such a weird metaphor, you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, yeah. I guess it's kind of like, I would expect there to be extra bricks in case one of them is, like, damaged or something. Like when you buy something, it has extra screws in case you miss, like, one.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing. So I thought it may have just been, like, a spare brick of some sort. Like, that's what I didn't understand.
It was perfect, and he destroyed it because he thought he missed a detail.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that detail was, maybe she is talking about her dad, and her dad stopped believing in the joke because of what he learned about Adrian, and she wouldn't let something like that bother her because it's all crazy. She comes from an even more chaotic point of view. I'm not sure. I'm also not sure if this means that Lori is the mastermind, which would be interesting. We can get to that at the end of the joke.
Yeah, I don't think Lori's the mastermind at all. But what I loved is they built into the joke. So she tells the joke and she's in the phone booth because this whole episode, I think she's sharing the story as she's in the phone booth. And the joke continues and the joke continues. But as she's doing it, and I discovered this and I pointed it out to my co-host guy, so I'm leading into it. As she's doing it, she's walking into a bank, and I will swear on my mother and on a Bible that that bank looks just like the bank from the opening of Dark Knight.
I think it's supposed to evoke that. I don't know if it is the same one, but I think it's definitely supposed to evoke that.
Because she walks in, and the bank's there, and I'm watching this, and I'm like, oh my god. And she draws the gun, and she's robbing it, but this time she's the good guy, and the guy who walks in looks just like Batman, and Batman's the bad guy. And I was like, mind blown.
Well, he's...
But was he the bad guy?
Well, he's the bad guy.
He's the lawbreaker. But
yeah. It was definitely a sting. But this is, I mean, you know, Commissioner Gordon's tried this to Batman at different points as well.
But it's a nice little, we could talk about my supposed Marvel reference later in the episode, but it was a nice little DC nod because it's definitely, to me at least, supposed to invoke Batman. So I'm like, okay, this is really cool. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. And the guy's name is Mr. Shadow, which isn't the Shadow sometimes like consider like a contemporary of Batman in ways.
Yeah, the Shadow was pre-Batman, but it might have been like it felt like it was one of those things that kind of inspired by, I mean, the Shadow was like radio plays days. I guess the 30s. But yeah, they're very similar. The Shadow could make himself invisible. And that was the whole thing on the radio. Of course, you could pull that off very easily where suddenly, you know, the scene would be going on and suddenly the Shadow would reveal himself. But it was audio, so, yeah. I highly recommend you listen to them. I know I'm old. I'm not that old. I listened to a bunch of cassette tape in the 80s. So.
I know they had, like, a comic, not recently, but, like, in the past, like, 10, 15 years, I remember seeing solicitations.
But yeah, he was originally the Revenger, so that I think is the play on who was actually the one they got last month, right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, he's definitely supposed to look like Batman. Did anyone else notice that the newspaper that the dude was reading?
The Grisham. John Grisham?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know. I was like, is that a John Grisham reference? Wow.
It's in the Wikipedia too. It's in one of the news articles. I think it's a New Frontiersman news article about Justice Grisham was retiring.
Oh gosh. So she goes through and she has her she does this, and I, you know, and admittedly, when we're talking about Batman, I was like, man, that is a lot of effort to catch a vigilante. But then I'm thinking of the things that Gordon would do to catch Batman initially before he put him to work for him. And I was like, no, that makes a lot of sense. And I loved it because Sister Knight, it feels like, will be Laurie's Batman or Batperson in this case. And I'm really excited to see where their relationship goes.
Yeah.
No, I think that I think that you're probably right. And I think that they're like the more extreme violent version, because Laurie is trigger happy as fuck. And Angela beats the shit out of anyone who's not giving her a straight answer. So I think that, yeah, they'll end up having that kind of partnership down the road, even though they're set up right now at very extreme odds. But like Laurie shooting that suspect, like the vigilante, like it literally reminded me of those awful videos of cops shooting suspects as they run away. Like I was literally like, homegirl. And then you obviously she didn't know or care if his arm, he had armor that protected him from bullets or not. Like it was just like she did not give a single fuck, and that was cold as hell.
Yeah, well, I think like especially in context of the later scene, I think it's just she does not care. Like she's just not like, whatever he's been.
Well, think of who, you know, who basically raised her. Like she had a father who thought life was a joke, and then Dr. Manhattan who thought the same number of atoms. And then of course, you know, she's been holding the secret about Adrian. What's one guy when you're holding the secret about like 10 million people? So I think that's got to mess with her sense of morality. But yeah, she really does not suffer fools.
So, okay. But I love her because she comes in and she, Jean Smart is channeling Jeffrey Dean Morgan and the comedian from the comics. Like she's somehow doing both. And it's amazing because you can 100% tell that she may have been related to Sally Jupiter, but she's not Sally Jupiter's daughter. And actually Wendy tweeted a comic book panel that I hope Wendy and Vanessa will put into the blog, where she's like, you know, something with leather and maybe carrying a gun. And I was like, yes, this is
the last scene. He's trying to talk her into staying home and being a mother. And she's like, no, that's not going to happen. And he's like, she wants to go out adventuring. He's like, well, how about Night Owl and the Silk Spectre? And she's like, no, that's too girly. How about something with leather and a gun?
Yeah, and then we found out she actually, you know, eventually became the comedian, like, spelled in the feminine way or whatever, but like that was like a really awesome choice that they carried that through. And you can see like she has such a swagger that reminds me like you said, like of Jeffrey Dean Morgan. Like it's crazy, like the way she walks around, I'm just like, oh my goodness, like it literally, it feels like she's at any point like on site will fight anybody, like your grandmother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like it's really impressive acting, I think.
Yeah.
Above all else, like, because I don't know how much research they gave her or what, but she gets it. She just, it is perfect. I don't know how.
Yeah.
I don't really want to, I guess we'll talk about that official podcast later, but like, I do want to kind of know like the behind the scenes kind of stuff on that, because whoever spoke with her or she just knows the content that well, it's really perfect.
Oh yeah, no, 100%, and even that sense of isolation, like, you get a real feel as she finishes up with the thing, and she goes to her apartment, you get a real feel that she's Edward Blake's kid, like, that is what she does, and I love the CD player, where she's like, play Devo, because it's part Alexa, and then part, like, old school,
because they haven't, there's no internet, so you have to, there's voice activated, but no internet.
That was so crazy. Like, it's just the minute details. And she goes in and she's got the thing in the case and she's just by herself.
But she's got two lovers and she's got two lovers and she loves them both the same. And keep talking about this. But yeah, the mouse, and she just kind of cavalierly tosses it in. She does this like every day. She brings home a box with a mouse in it. And then the combination on the box is 667. Does anybody have any idea what that could be? Is it like one past the devil? You know?
Yeah, I think that's probably like, in some way, it's like close to the devil, or but not quite. Like, I think that's all I could think of.
Over the line. It's, and so I think they met in 66 when she was 16. But I don't know what the 7 is.
And why,
was it in July?
Yeah. So is there a 0 on those kind of locks?
I do not know. Yeah, of course, it's another universe, so who knows? Yeah.
Because I would guess, like, if it was in it, then if it was a reference to that, it would say 066 and not 667. Yeah. So I don't know.
That's the combination. You don't have to see at this point what's in the box.
Oh, the owl, though. That's like a who's on first kind of joke, right?
Except yeah, I know.
And it is okay. A joke.
God, all the comedian joke like callbacks is so ridiculous. I was like, yeah, we get it. She makes jokes.
There's a joke, though, that made me think of on TikTok, because I'm in my 30s and I'm on TikTok. Everybody leave me alone. But there was a joke that made me think of that. There was an audio going around where there's two people, and one person says, okay, guys, we have to be careful. Someone in the room is possessed by an owl. And the other person goes, who? And the first person says, that's the idea. We don't know. And then they stop and they stare at the person that says, who?
So it's going around. This is still a dad joke, right?
Absolutely.
Which makes sense, because Dan Dreyberg is like the ultimate. He's a dad in jail, but he's still a dad.
Very dad, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, well, here's the other thing I wanted to point out is that we're all talking about Dan in jail, Dreyberg.
Dan is in general custody.
He's not as cool as Don Draper. But somebody was talking about how old she was, and I was like, she's like, oh, she's 70. Like, she's not 70. She's like, well, she was 16 and 66. She's 69. It's pretty much 70. And if you think about that, and Dan was in his late 20s, maybe 30 when they met, and that would put him at like 85.
How long has he been in jail for? Did the PDPDSA say?
I think it said since like 95 or something.
Yeah, 95 has been in federal custody.
Yeah, once Rorschach Journal was becoming a problem.
Wow. Okay, so, but Keen comes in. Is anybody else bothered by how Keen is like, he's doing way more? I can't think of a single senator. Maybe that's just because I'm an embittered American who recognizes that this country doesn't really care about people. I can't think of a single senator who would like actively go to people's homes without like 50 billion bodyguards and like investigative stuff. You know what I mean?
I'm pretty sure he's, I mean, not just because of the PDPDO letter, but like that whole, the scene at the funeral and everything. It seems like he's like, he knows he's safe.
Yeah, he's running the show. So, mm-hmm. I think he knows enough of what's going on. He may be part of the being in control, which would be interesting, but I don't think he's at the core of it.
Oh no, 100%. So Keen insists that she goes and investigates. And that's when we kind of get to see the viewpoint of the FBI in this world where vigilantes exist and cops have been given license to be vigilantes. I have something I want to bring up about that later, because they introduced...
Wait. We skipped over something really cool. One really cool thing before I leave the scene. The Warhol picture.
Yes. Oh my God, how could I forget about
that? That was amazing.
So in the scene there is an Andy Warhol's picture in the style of Andy Warhol's Marilyn Monroe picture. And if you remember in the movie, they did they showed a scene in the title sequence where Andy Warhol was unveiling his Night Owl series, mm-hmm. which we assume there was other Watchmen in the series, but what was the last one called? One in the '60s.
You're talking about Crime Busters?
Yes, thank you, Tony.
Okay, sorry.
It took us a minute. I swear we know what we're doing, world. Okay. We do.
It's good. All right, we got it. So the Crime Busters, I assume they had all the crime in the paintings, but they only really showed in the credit sequence Night Owl. But here we have all four of them. And the best part about it is she's literally sitting in front of her head in the Warhol picture. And then she leans forward mm-hmm. and you can see younger her. In case you didn't put it together.
That was pretty obvious. I love that they named every character this, like, that we were all suspecting or whatever this episode, because and they did it in a really awesome way. And I kind of loved, from a person who makes gifts perspective, I was like, ooh, that's beautiful. Cause it was just like the way she leaned and she was like, the way she said Oklahoma. And it was just, it was just beautiful.
All of it. And I love that when we're talking about how, because when we get to Petey, because we're going to have to get to Petey, I kind of love how they're assembling the descendants of Watchmen in a way. And I'm going to explain that more once we get to Petey. But I just, the fact that it was like Lori is kind of taking charge here and she's in this. It's like maybe not even the descendants of the Crime Busters, but the descendants of like the Minutemen. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Because you have like all these different characters and they're like connected to the previous generation. And it just goes to show you that we don't really... we don't really let go or lose our mistakes, or, that we just kind of, without major stopping points, we'll just keep repeating them. And I just had the best idea in the world. What if when they get a season two, because this is going to get a season two, I refuse to listen to the three of you not saying that it's going to get a season two. But what if we follow the kid, Bass Reeves? What if we follow him? And it's like the Watchmen before, or the Minutemen before the Minutemen, and it's like 1800 superheroes. Huh?
That's an interesting concept. He's a real person, so you wouldn't need the Watchmen license for that. But I think, going back, I feel like there might have been a movie. I'll look it up for next week. I'll find out for next week. I feel like there might have been a recent movie about Bass Reeves. Or he was in a role-playing game I was in. I'm not going to say which.
But no, you follow the kid. You follow the kid from the Tulsa Massacre. And you show how the superhero's world-building has been happening. That would be incredible.
But he happened in our world, and we didn't end up with superheroes. But it would be interesting to see what actually was different that split the two worlds.
Yes.
The only thing, I guess, is... like, if that kid is, like, actually the Hooded Justice, then mm-hmm. it just becomes a Minutemen movie or a Minutemen series.
So we've moved on to the FBI.
So she cuts back and forth to her talking, and I'm only because I'm going through the episode as we talk, and she's in this phone booth, and it is literally a toilet. I mean, people, like, it's any blue box that you put out there is going to get used inappropriately.
I mean, weren't all phone booths toilets, though, if you tried really hard enough?
Oh, they're all pretty gross.
These are the jokes. These are the jokes.
Don't go into a phone booth. Just use one of the open phones. All right.
Did anybody get full joke?
The what joke?
The joke that she's telling, because she sets up the rest of the episode with this joke, and it's the three superheroes go to the gates of heaven, and they die, they go to the gates, at the pearly gates, and then the owl is the first one who comes up.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's what leads into the FBI, and then into her going into the funeral scene, doesn't it? Or am I...
She's saying, why are these particular scenes lining up with those scenes?
Yeah.
I thought she was kind of going, from, bad to what she thought was worse,
Well, didn't it line up with, because she's, the first owl one was right after he referenced him being, letting him go, basically, if she cooperated with the investigation. And then the Ozymandias reference was, I thought, was after Petey mentioned, and then the Doc one, I can't remember what, but I think they were all lined up with someone referencing them previously in her life.
Yeah, I mean, part of me felt like this was, in case you'd never read Watchmen, or it's a long time ago and you forgot, let's do a brief run now.
Yeah.
Refresh.
And then, of course, the end of the joke was about, you know, you all underestimated me, but I'm really the baddest one out of the whole group. There's probably way more to that that I'll understand in future episodes, but that's kind of, I think, the surface level reading on that.
So she's in the FBI, and they discuss the history of the 7th Cavalry, and that's where we meet Petey.
Petey!
Running the projector.
I don't like him, but I'm worried. I'm worried he's evil. But
I really like him a lot. He's so fun. He's just, I don't know. I just want to give him a nice hug. I don't know if anyone watches Silicon Valley, but he reminds me a lot of Jared, and I'm just... I feel like I want to adopt him. So I really am a big, I hope he's not evil or anything.
I feel like he might be.
The fact that he included Rorschach's journal in the middle of all of the information about Tulsa. So the chief is going over, the FBI chief is going over the facts of the 7th Cavalry. And that's when we first learned that officially, at least for Tulsa, that people, and again, I use this term very sparingly, fully knowing that I might be getting it wrong, that people have been getting some reparations for racial violence.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so this particularly, because this is all in the PDPedia, the details, this particularly was that Keene in Tulsa, and I believe it was spearheaded by Keene, but in Tulsa, they decided to do this reparations for specifically the Tulsa Massacre, which brought every descendant of a Tulsa massacre victim back.
And
of course, that plus all the money helped out the economy in the town, but of course the guy says, it brings out the white supremacists. Before we get too far in also talking about PDPedia, the big reason why I think he might be evil is he writes this really toxic fan memo to everybody in the FBI office about American Hero Story. I mean, it was like the worst.
I kind of find it hilarious, but whatever.
I
have different opinions.
I don't know if that makes him evil, but
I think he makes him annoying, but I don't think it makes him evil.
Like he was trying to write, the writing style of it was he was trying to be this is an inadequate, and then in parentheses he'd be all but whatever, I don't care, like how I'm talking now. he was really trying to be proper, but then he you could tell he was a fanboy, even though he was trying to say he wasn't. He was definitely a fanboy.
But does that equate, and we could go, this is a whole podcast in and of itself, but does that equate to a toxic sort of fandom if you're correcting somebody? Because let's pause for a moment, okay? Because he uses words that defame a certain people, but so do people in the Star Wars fandom when it comes to George Lucas. So I'm not saying that to be perfectly frank, whenever somebody mentions anything related to words toxic and fandom, I've developed an instinctive trust for cis heterosexual white men who are in fandom at this point. And anybody can feel free to debate me or argue with me on this, because it's just true. And so, but I'm curious as to why. And I think that the issue with this one is that, does he have a point? Because he makes a valid point that he knows what he's talking about, or at least he seems to know what he's talking about. He could have been lying through his teeth at Lori, because I wouldn't put it past him. Because some people could say, oh, well, I've done this and I worked for Lucasfilm. And it's like, you worked for Lucasfilm, bitch? You swept the floor. You were a janitor. You didn't work for anybody. But at the same time, it's like, does he have a valid point? Does he not? That's just something to keep in mind. There's no clear observational point in any of this. And I'm not defending the guy, but I do think that, when we say toxic fandom, you have to be aware that there's people, is it, what makes that, what makes up that up? What's that made up of? What's the dichotomy there?
So, I find it interesting that we're calling it toxic fandom when he specifically says he's not a fan. So it's interesting that you guys are applying that onto him when he literally is just like, I just know my shit. PDPedia aside, people who may not read PDPedia, I want to stick to the actual show,
right.
is the fact of the matter is he literally, she treats him like you guys are actually treating him. Like, she literally initially treats him like, literally, like, the fuck, you want my autograph? Like, the fuck off me. And which I initially had that reaction. I'm like, dude is such a fanboy. Oh my God, get off her. And I even wrote it in my notes. I was like, he's fanboying so hard. And he specifically was like, I'm not. I'm like, I just know what I'm talking about. Like, I blah, blah, blah. And like, she obviously was like, okay, let me step off a sec, because she's not stupid. Like, she's a pretty smart, she's a smart ass woman. She knows that for a second, she needs to just maybe not bite his head off for a second. So I thought that scene was interesting, because I think she wanted to, I think she had to readjust in that moment. So I thought that was awesome.
I have a theory about him as well, though. I think she brought him specifically because he reminded her of Night Owl, and she might need a snack later.
I think Laurie chose Petey because of his Rorschach knowledge, because everyone's point, like, literally the homeboy, the boss, completely disregarded the Rorschach stuff and was like, no, who gives a fuck about Rorschach? But it's like, she looked at him at that point, and she, like, I think that's when she basically was like, I think I wanted to bring him along. Maybe she decided it was a snack later on, but yeah, I think this. I thought it was the Rorschach.
Yeah, she definitely decided that she was going to hit the buffet table right there with him.
We'll talk about that when we get there. You are right, and I thought it was very odd that he was the only one in the room who wanted to talk about Rorschach when dealing with the cavalry.
And it makes the most sense. I think it's weird that they would dismiss it, right?
Yeah, because you would. In some ways, I think it's weird, but some ways I get it. Like, because, okay, how much do you need to know about white supremacists? Like, for the most part.
Well, it wasn't established. Like, that's what I'm saying. Like, he wasn't an established white supremacist. White supremacists gathered around his ideology.
They adopted it.
Yeah. So I think that was, I feel like if you're trying to understand white supremacy and, like, these terrorists, why wouldn't you go to the source and the ideology and figure that out, too? That's why I think that's weird, and that makes me feel like something or someone is trying to dampen that down. Like, so they were like, hey, don't dig into Rorschach too much, because, you know, Rorschach was lying.
Well, really, yeah, that's the trigger there. Even though he is who he is and who he has inspired, he's correct.
Yeah. Which is,
what happened in the 80s? Because apparently, was that a big thing? Was it like, I can't really think of an equivalent event to something like that. But what happened in the 80s that people were so worked up about when it comes to Rorschach? I mean, yeah, the journal was published, but did something happen that made people believe it? Because
they said they dismissed it out of hand, but the New Frontiersman printed it, like, chapter by chapter, well, in PDPedia. So then it became like a cult thing.
Yeah. There was a whole fringe memo thing. Yeah, the peace came, and then these people started coming up trying to talk about, you know, Veidt and the conspiracies, mm-hmm. and then that had threatened the peace, you know. So it was probably bad, is my guess. I mean, you're seeing what the cavalry's doing now, but
yeah.
But yeah, so there may be some, and again, like, you know, the other assumption could be that everyone's read Rorschach's journal. You know, and that we don't need to go over this again. This is 101, but, you know, I don't know what you're supposed to really get out of that.
Yeah.
All right.
He said he had a PhD in history, and what else? Did he say, like, what he was doing before he became FBI? I can't remember. Exactly.
I think he did, but I don't remember what it was.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if it's relevant or not. Yeah. You know, I mean, PhD, it shows interest in a thing, but even if he's not, like, a fan, as we've been saying, I do wonder, like, if that fascination is beyond the norm or the healthy level or however you want to say it. I don't know, because, like, I guess if they're putting the PDPedia out there, so even if he's, like, evil, he's not, like, there's some truth to it, I think. Otherwise, why would they be adding supplementary information mm-hmm. like that?
Oh, no, yeah, he would just be, I mean, but again, like, it's Watchmen, right? Like, we can go back to this.
Yeah.
It's very hard to say who's evil and who's good, and I think we're starting, maybe we were led to believe one thing, like, but I feel like now we're starting to see, if you look at things from different perspectives, everybody's got a dark side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, I did notice that on the FBI bulletin about the FBI State Department bulletin about Judd's death, It says that he's a family friend of Joseph Keane Sr.'s, which we knew from the PDPedia, but it's apparently we're really supposed to pay attention to that.
Oh. So Lori agrees to take Petey. And Petey and Lori are on the plane. And
They talk about Vite.
And we get introduced to...
Wait. There's a lot here. There's a lot. I don't want to skip over the Vite, but let's...
Go for it.
Oh, yeah. So they see the Millennium Clock out the window. And the Millennium Clock is like this hand holding something spherical coming out of the ground. It's crazy. And I think this is going to be big. But the Millennium Clock joggled a memory of mine from a very long time ago, about 25 years ago, about 5 years before the millennium. There was an article in a special issue of Wired about the Millennium Clock. And really, it is an essay about time and about trying to kind of get a handle on what the millennium is and why. I don't know how much you guys, you know, thought about the millennium before it happened. But I mean, like when I was a kid growing up, you know, we all figured when we turned, I was 25 at the millennium, and I figured if we turned 25 and like it would be Mad Max. And, we'd all be fighting for survival. It's like people think about that you have to have a plan for the zombie apocalypse. If the zombie apocalypse happens, this is what we're going to do. People talk about that. This is kind of the same thing. But you really didn't, I mean, the year 2000 was the future. Conan O'Brien used to have this gag where we talked about what we were doing in the year 2000, and it was like 1998, right? but it always seemed like, you know, and he's talking about how, yeah, you didn't really think about the future beyond that because 2000 was far enough away, and then suddenly it's only 5 years away when this article was written. And he goes through the whole thing.
I remember there being a spate of movies out that were about the end of the world.
Yeah, and that was the 80s. Like, I mean, there was also a bunch of those when 2012 came out. I mean, it's 10 years.
I think that's just the weed is good. People are worried.
Oh my God.
So at the end of the article ends with, you know, he goes he's asked to think about why he wants to build the clock, not, you know, how he's going to build the clock. But he wants to build a clock that would go from now until build it now so you could see the turn of the millennium and then have it go for 1,000 years until the next millennium and it would happen again. And this cuckoo that only comes out at the millennium. And he's got all these details about the clock. So the whole article is about the details about the clock and what it means for time. Da, 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 da. And finally, you know, he's asked why is it that you want to build this? What is the thing that you're really trying to do? It says, I had never thought about the clock as a question. It was more of an answer, although I wasn't sure to what. I talked more about the shrinking future, about the oak trees. Oh, I see, Sock said. You want to preserve something of yourself, just as I am preserving something of myself by having this conversation with you. I remembered this a few weeks later when he died. Be sure you think carefully about exactly what you want to preserve, he said. Okay, Jonas. Okay, people of the future. Here is the part of me that I want to preserve, and maybe the clock is my way of explaining it to you. I cannot imagine the future, but I can care about it. I know I am part of a story that starts long before I can remember and continues long beyond when anyone will remember me. I sense that I am alive at a time of important change, and I feel a responsibility to make sure that the change comes out well. I plant my acorns, knowing that I will never live to see harvest the oaks. I have hope for the future. This is written by Danny Hillis. Yeah, so that I think is there in the Millennium Clock. It's this idea of the Millennium Clock, and I'll put this link on the blog. You know, if anybody wants to read it, but I do think it was this kind of, again, this is the parting lines of Dr. Manhattan, Ozymandias, you know, about how nothing ever ends, right? And then this is kind of it. It's just the seeds, like we were just talking about, you know, with you know, Minuteman planting the seeds for Crime Busters, you know, planting the seeds for this next generation, planting the seeds for, and you know, the future keeps going. Yeah, this article is very optimistic, and I think maybe it was there too. And I think, the other thing to point out about Millennium is Adrian Vite Adrian Vite was pushing a perfume line known as Nostalgia, which immediately following the squid was replaced by a perfume line titled Millennium. So nostalgia looking backwards, Millennium looking towards this bright future. It was kind of his feeling of what life would be like after the squid.
Yeah.
I also thought it looked a bit like the, if we're going back to PDpedia, and I don't want to go too back to, but the kind of creepy letter that Keen wrote to Judd's father or grandfather about the painting had a kind of symbol in it that looked to me to be, you know, a little like an eye, like maybe the top of the Millennium clock does. Of course, it also looks like the Eye of Sauron, but that's a whole other story.
So there's... Yeah, I noticed, well, sorry, as a side note, going back to Pax Americana, the thing that invades that world is also symbolic of an eyeball, so thought that was cool, but you can go ahead, Carolyn.
No, you guys were, I want to hear about the eyeball.
Eyeballs are big in DC.
I guess so, which is odd, because you don't have eyeballs a lot in other... well, no, you kind of do, but the metaphysical and the weird I've noticed is also big in DC, and that's definitely something that's at play in this world. What I was going to say was, it's very interesting to me that he was thinking, even all, you know, ancillary, that he seemed to be looking forward towards a future of peace and prosperity. And one of the things with this, with the Keynes, the DOPA Act, and I have to remember what that means really quick, because I wrote it down because Lori was so impressed by it being DOPA, the Defense of Police Act.
Yeah.
You know, because it's like, you're a dope, the Defense of Police Act, but crime in Tulsa is down 80%, and eventually we're going to get to the point where I have they introduced a new vigilante cop, and I'm not sure if they're a detective or they're just in charge of something. Did you guys see the new vigilante cop in the Dog's Head?
Oh no,
I saw that in the trailer, and I was wondering if that was just like an odd a choice, or if that's like a special canine unit specifically, like those are the dog guys, you know what I mean? Because he was holding a dog, wasn't he?
He was holding two dogs, but yeah. Even it's such a subtle, and I think we're actually ironically leading into that, because Lori ends up landing in Tulsa, and the first place that she goes isn't the first place she goes to the police. I seem to recall that. So the first place she goes is to the police warehouse.
Before she
have Vite. Yeah, we talk about Vite, and then she does the second part of her joke about Ozzy and Smarty Pants, she calls him.
Mr. Smarty Pants.
Mm-hmm. And he's like, yeah, basically like calling him a monster. And I love that she's basically funneling her opinions about these three men through God's judgment, which is fascinating.
She's not well in traditional terms, but I just love that she's not taking any shit from anybody. She's just like, nope. But she tells the second part of the joke where Ozymandias goes up to God, and God, Mr. Smarty Pants, and God's like, what did you do with the big brain I gave you? And God, and Mr. Smarty Pants says, I saved the world. And God says, oh, how'd you do that? And he says, by killing 3 million people. And then God, quote unquote, says, my God, you're a monster. And it's true. And then she goes into the police department, and Lori has made it very clear in multiple parts of this episode and in all the trailers and supplemental material that we've seen, that she doesn't agree with masks. She has a whole diatribe in the FBI room about masks, and even when dealing with the vigilantes and the bank robber scene, like, she doesn't like vigilantes for a reason. So when she sees the police all wearing masks, the camera cuts to Dogman, to Silverhead Dogman. And Silverhead Dogman has these two absolutely feral looking dogs on leashes, and they're ready to like rip the shit out of everybody. And see, I'm familiar with security dogs, because at Disneyland we have regular security dogs that, you know, wander up and down and sniff at people, and they're very sweet dogs. You can't pet them But, you know, they're, because they're working, it's like, you can't pet a cast member while they're working. You can't pet the cast the working animals either. So you can't pet them, but they're walking back and forth. These dogs look like they're really off the leash. And when you see all these people in masks who are roughing up all of these white supremacists, because I'm willing to bet that they are, even if they're not, or they're, like, kind of shuffled in.
Like,
and kind of
indoctrined, kind of, like.
Yeah.
Like, they are, like, probably sympathetic or something to it. But, yeah.
Yeah, sympathetic, or they're, or you know, they might be sympathetic after what happens with this, because Lori's looking around and she's seeing all these people who are supposed to be the law who have become genuine monsters. And the camera really, but the camera really focuses on Doghead, which is why I'm just going to call him Doghead until we get another name for him. Camera focuses on Doghead, and the image of the dogs off the leash is a very poignant one, because what little I know about the history of this country, I do know that there have been several instances where dogs have been used as very, very violent weapons against other human beings, especially in regards to racially tense situations, in regards to racial violence. So the fact that they had these dogs, and then they have all these images of all these cops beating the absolute shit out of these people. And Lori's looking around at it, and it's like, wow. She's starting to realize that giving people a mask and refusing to let them be who they are is what drives people crazy. Not crazy.
It definitely escalates the situation. It was definitely meant to make you see the other side, like, from the cop's perspective. And now it's like, Matt, this is the outsider coming in, seeing the chaos of the situation.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, I saw some people, like, kind of not liking some of, well, anyway, it's like part of this, and also like the general themes of the show in a way, where like do you want to frame it as cops are treating white supremacists unfairly? Like for me, like my perspective, I can watch it and just say, oh, well, it's just trying to say that all people are kind of gross on the inside in some way. But I kind of do see it like kind of what they mean, like, even if you're going to show cops going too far, is this the almost appropriate or responsible way to do it in a way? Which, I mean, it's something to think about, not to interrupt you too much or anything like that. But no, it is, but kind you, of a...
Just because you're right about something, doesn't I think, I feel like that we're going to find out at the end that all of this was manufactured. And people were doing the right thing. They were going with their conscience, or they were doing what they thought was right. But at the same time, it was being used by somebody else, like, you know, of a bite-like character.
I don't like the idea that all of this is manufactured, because white supremacy isn't, like, this is,
no.
There's an overarching conspiracy, sure, but at the end of the day, it can only be built off the back of white supremacy and the deeply rooted hatred that's always existed in this country. So I think that part of it is the cops beating the shit out of showcasing police brutality. Police brutality is bad no matter who it is. Like, it doesn't matter if you're an arm of the law and you're violating the rights of people, you're in the wrong regardless. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter, you know.
Yeah.
I guess you could apply to if you're saying, oh, domestic terrorists don't have rights and they don't deserve it, that's a whole Bush era level thinking that I'm not ready to pick apart right now. But I think that there's just like a lot of layers to this that isn't, you can't just all wrap up into a conspiracy or whatever. It's just this is the base of human reality. I mean, this shit was happening. This happens in our reality. Mm-hmm. I was just looking at an article. You know, Chicago is holding warehouses of and beating the shit out of, you know, suspects, you know, illegally. Like, this happens in our reality too. Like,
jeez, I agree. I agree with you, Vanessa, because as a I cannot speak to the full brutality of American policing. As a person who was homeless, I was very unfortunate to witness the dichotomy of police, of the idea of policing, because within the span of 24 hours, I had and I'm not going to go into detail because it is an extremely personal and it is a very dark subject, but within the span of 24 hours, I had a police officer save my life and save the life of everybody else on the block, and then I had a police officer assault somebody in front of me. So the dichotomy becomes people who think that they have anonymity. And I think that that is what Lori is, that's what Lori sees as the problem.
It's what they're showing you, what Lori's showing you. But yeah. Lori goes up to that dude in the car and she's like, are they violating your civil rights, sir? And he starts to listen. She's like, I don't really care.
Yeah, she doesn't care.
I think she's triggered.
It's complicated, I think. I think she's jaded.
Yeah, I think she's a nihilist. Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
She's a nihilist. I think she stopped giving a fuck.
Yeah, like I think she started this year. Yeah. I mean, really though, her soul broke. Like we saw it. We saw her. I mean, but that was another thing. I have a note like for like later on, but like I read it like something earlier. Someone said that, you know, her mom groomed her to be the Silk Spectre too. And I was like, but didn't Doc also groom her too? Like she's been groomed since she was a kid to be something else. To be someone else, and like now we're seeing her choosing her like path, and like seeing her confronted with her past is such a it's so wild to see it play across her face, and then she just switches back to like her comedian kind of personality right when she gets to one of my favorite parts of the episode, her versus Wade. And also, can we give a shout out to Pirate Jenny? Jessica Camacho is so good. She's just been on the screen for like less than 10 seconds and she just has so much content. Oh, I need more.
Dear everyone, please cosplay Pirate Jenny because her outfit.
Yes! Like that whole outfit, that look, I was like, she looks so good. Anyway.
Yes.
But yes, Mr. Wade, Detective Wade Tillman, we finally get a name out of Looking Glass.
I think they did say Wade like first episode, but I don't know if we ever got the last.
No, oh, I rewatched it this morning. They did not say Wade. I had to rewatch it because I had my roommate rewatching it, and my roommate.
Oh yeah, their dog, the dog.
My it roommate. Says it in the script.
Oh okay, that may have been it. I may have seen it in the.
The subtitles. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I watched it.
She says, or you could just take that silly mask off, Wade.
Detective Tillman.
My roommate is watching the series, but she hasn't seen the movies or read the book.
Oh, Lord.
So she's like, what the fuck is going on?
I love it. Yes. She's like, pure. Oh, purest, fresh-driven snow.
We started from episode one, and she looks at me, and I'm trying to explain things to her, and she goes, okay, can I watch this without knowing anything else about it? And I was like, I mean, maybe. And she goes, okay, because I'm not going to remember anything you fucking say.
Aw, I love it. Oh, my God. I want to hear her opinion. You have to, like, give us at least one quote from her.
Yeah, like the
I'm sure she'd be. I'm sure she'd be willing to appear on the podcast next Monday.
I would love to hear her opinion.
Okay, yeah, no, I'll definitely do that. But Looking Glass. I love him.
I love him. Oh my God. Okay. I'm just like, that was the only one that loved him because he's just so, I don't know if it's the accent. There's something about his accent I just really like. It's kind of soothing, y'all. I don't know. I'm weird.
Have you ever watched Oh Brother, Where Art Thou with George Clooney?
No. Is it bad if I said no?
No, because he's in that and he sings.
Oh, okay. That just went up my list.
Mm-hmm. And he's in a couple of other things, but he's kind of not typecast as those like down home Southern people, but he's a really good actor, and I really don't want him to be evil. I really like the idea of a good actor.
He's good, but I feel like he's definitely, he might be, like, he felt really good in this one, but at the same time, he was also, you could see, and this was disturbing me a lot, you could see how he was disturbed by Sister Knight, and knowing what if you look at what he knows and how suspicious she is acting, and he doesn't know why, if he is not a Klan member, then he doesn't know what was going on with Judd, then he's definitely looking at her like she might be a suspect.
At Angela?
Yeah.
Or... Well, I think that's probably going to get wrapped up by, because the next episode, I think, well, we can talk about that later. Yeah. I don't think that's going to last very long, but I think that we have to at least, I don't know, maybe not. I don't know what Damon's thinking, but we have to at least have There's no way we're going to have a show without at least one good white guy. Like, that's impossible, right? It's 2019. We're not going to have a show without a one good white guy. I feel like Wade's going to be our one good white guy.
But the problem, though, I foresee is that if he's good, I don't think he's going to live that.
No, absolutely. He's definitely going to die. You're right. Yep. We're going to have one good white guy, but he's going to die.
If it's, and you know, possibly as he should, but what we should discuss is because she's talking to him and they talk about the pod, and she calls the pod a racist detector. Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty much what it is, right?
I'm very curious to hear what everybody thought of that.
I thought it was, because I would think that they'd use it for everything, not just the 7th Cavalry stuff, but maybe they're in such a utopia that that's literally the only crime that's going on.
That's true, because 80% down crime, like, what else do you have besides, like, you know, the domestic terrorists?
Well, yeah, but I mean, there are any kind of predisposed, like, inherent bias, right? I mean, you should be able to use that, reconfigure the pictures. You want to get a confession out of someone, you can keep showing them pictures, you know, right, that will break their heart. I mean, like, it's a kind of torture, but I mean, I get it. You know, showing, you know, images and reading micro expressions, it's like, you know, deprogramming, decoding people. You know, it reminds me a bit again of Westworld, when they had the codes for people. Mm-hmm. You know, and they were really small books. Like, it's very easy to decode, you know, based on a person's reactions to reverse engineer, you know, what their thoughts are.
Well, and go ahead.
Well, I was going to make an obscure pop culture reference. I would rather hear what you have to say.
Oh, I would say, like, I thought it was interesting that he kept arguing against the racist detector description. Like, I just really love him going, that's an oversimplification. Sorry. Yeah, I love his accent so much, you guys. But he was, like, really adamant about it not being called that. And I really don't know why. And I'm ready to hear all of your guys' theories, and y'all can tweet them at me, because I really want to know why he. Because I don't see what maybe it's like a perspective thing. Like, maybe they don't want to, it's like optics. Like, we can't call it a racist detector because that's like such an objective thing, maybe. I don't know. But like, and not that objective, but I'm just curious as to why he would, because a couple of times you called it that and he was just like getting frustrated. You can see him getting visibly flustered by her, which it's weird because she is the only person that's managed to ruffle his feathers besides that one moment in the car with Angela, you know?
Yeah, I guess my interpretation. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead. Okay. No, please speak.
My interpretation was actually that because I can't imagine he would become this specialized only in terms of detecting racism. I'm sure. Right. I'm wondering if it's like if it's meant to be like how PD was like, no, I'm a historian. Ooh, and I know.
Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah.
I wonder if he's just like a really like a psychological expert in general. And so when she says it's almost like she's diminishing his skill to say it's only for detecting racists. But
you're being so generous. I mean, I think that, you know, Akum's razor here is that white people don't like it when you call them out on their racism. So he doesn't want to say someone's a racist, but you know.
But he specifically does people. Though. He calls them. You know what he does though. He lets the whole thing of the pod is detecting. But I think the point is that it's not the only thing. Yeah. That's not the only thing it's for. But we haven't seen what else it's used for. Currently, we're only seeing it used on white supremacists. So I don't know.
I'm going to take the complete opposite tact of what Wendy said, and I'm going to say that chances are he doesn't want to. Not because I don't think you can ever eradicate. I don't think you could ever eradicate racism, even in this alternate reality. But I was going to say, I don't think he wants to call it a racism detector because he just genuinely, I think he sees it as a genuine crime. I think, and that might also be even worse in a way because he doesn't necessarily see it as a crime based on, you know, skin color. But I think he would just see it as a crime of, you know, trying to see people as, you know, we're just looking at this in terms of people who have been attacked and people who have been hurt. So
it's like saying, I don't see color. It's, you know, it's like,
yeah, no, it's wrong.
It's kind of a cop out, right?
It is a cop out, but you know, you have to, I don't know that when they officially were like, no, I can't even begin to trace that line of thought. I still say he might be a decent person, but that's worth looking into because he was genuinely like upset about it. So
I'm interested in seeing how this follows, like how this conversation follows up after the next episode when she presents him with the materials, because I really want to know what his reaction is to like blatant racism. I mean, he deals with it every single day, but maybe he's just gotten desensitized to it. Who knows? I mean, I have fucking eye. But I deal with it every day, so I don't know. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Interesting theories. So then we get, what are we at? So where are we at? The funeral.
They arrive at the hotel, and the only thing I need to say here from is that it is called the Black Freighter.
Yeah. actually, before that, I did think it was interesting they noted that he did not have a toxicology report done.
Mm-hmm. Everybody knew.
Because he was on coke, and the homeboy was high out of his ass.
But I do wonder if there's going to be something to that, because it was mentioned a couple of times in that exchange.
Are drugs legal in this world? Did they see, because it was tossed that he was on coke. Did they legalize drugs?
I have not seen any indication that that's true, but it's supposed to be like a liberal utopia. So perhaps, it's a big liberal thing, right?
The mummies in the Andes Mountains, the human sacrifices of children, they did toxicology reports on them. And the months prior to their sacrifice, they were given a lot of narcotics. and good food and wine and everything else, but they were given drugs so that they wouldn't be afraid of what they knew was going to happen to them. And I'm wondering if Judd knew that he was going to be used as a sacrifice. Ooh. Or he just likes to do blow in the kitchen after a successful mission.
No, but that's an interesting line of thought, though, because now that we know the connection between the Crawfords and the Keens, I mean, if there's a bigger, higher cause, you know, people do that. That's like the sacrifice themselves for a higher cause. Yeah. I can see it happening. That's an interesting thought.
You did mention Vanessa in the first episode when you had the guy with the cyanide pill. It's like, you have to really, truly, if you want to kill yourself, you have to really, truly believe in what you're doing.
The cause, absolutely. Willing to die for it? Yeah.
What's very interesting to me is when they've gone to the, and we haven't gotten to the infamous, we have not gotten to the sex toy scene.
Mm-hmm. That's further down.
Yeah.
That is further down. So we're getting into the graveyard scene, and I want to know how many.
Tartarus.
Okay. So in Greek mythology.
Yeah.
Tartarus was where they kept the most dangerous and problematic shades, and so all of the people who were truly, truly evil went to Tartarus, and they, including Kronos, we're talking about time, including Kronos, father of the original Greek pantheon, as well as the one who swallowed all of his kids. And I only know this because I've been reading Lore Olympus. Everybody go read Lore Olympus. No, not going to plug any other new media in this podcast. But Tartarus is where they keep all these people, including Kronos, which is time. So you have to wonder... Are the Crawfords, the Keens, evil because they're burying Judd in this? But even then, after what happens in the cemetery, they kind of rebuke that because Tartarus is supposed to be where the bad guys go. But ultimately, he's not buried in Tartarus. He's left drifting on the wind.
that was terribly gross to me. She had to do it, but ew. You know? I don't know.
I'm going to go home and take a bath.
It's, yeah, no.
Hey, let's not skip over the whole
funeral. Yeah, yeah, we'll get there. So, no, the funeral scene, oh my God, guys, the first, we get a first, I've been anticipating this since before, we get Jean Smart and Regina King in a scene together. The sparks fly, guys, I'm shipping it. I don't know, I'm sorry, I'm here for it. I don't care, I love it. They're so good together. The everything, the tension. Can you guys, can we talk about that? I know I'm a conspiracy theorist, but like when she goes, she says Angela, or like she's a dresser, and then she goes, Cal, how are you? Like she knows him. What the fuck was that?
She wants to know him.
Ooh, I know. She was like, how is my husband? She was like, mm-hmm, I love. She's just like, I don't give a fuck. I will fuck your man. I love her.
A menage a trois.
Oh, absolutely. I'm okay. OT3. I'm okay with them. Cool with it. Let's get it out. And if Dr. Manhattan wants to get involved, I'm cool with that too. It's HBO, baby. We're going this. We're going there.
We still have our suspicions about Cole, and she may have suspicions about Cole as well.
Al, yeah,
in the police report.
We got, but Lori knows her stuff. She walks in with such confidence. Mm-hmm. I've never seen a person walk into a cemetery with such confidence outside of a drag queen doing a drag show. She just
swagger.
Went swagger, sachet. All them buzzwords.
And I like Topher. I like how Topher was just giving her like a little stink eye.
I love Topher, guys. Oh my God.
Can we talk? As a non-binary person, as a trans person, I want to talk about Topher for a second. Because Topher presents in such a gender-neutral way.
Yeah.
And identifies as male. And I'm like, this is the kind of content that I want. We don't need to know his, we don't need to know his or their, we don't need to know the pronouns. We really don't. But they present in such, and I'm going to start using they for Topher, because Topher, it was originally Christopher. And then she corrects him in the second episode. She's like, no, it's Topher. And I'm like, Topher could easily be a gender neutral name. I'm just saying. So, and I'm probably reading way too much into that in particular, but I will say the kid is presenting very gender neutral, and I picked up on that, and I was like, okay, this is what I want to see, and nobody's batting an eyelash about it. So shockingly, all of those people who think that non-binary gendered people don't exist, or that gendered clothing and everything else is a problem, can go fuck themselves when they are watching this, because nobody's batting an eye at this kid, and the kid is literally presenting gender neutral.
Is it just the hair? What else am I missing? Is it just, I know I'm not great at this, but is it just the hair, or is it like, because a lot of boys just, right now have
very general neutral clothing.
Oh
yeah, I mean,
yeah. It's the cut of suits and the cut of tie and the hair is a part of it, but it's also the cut of the suits and the cut of the ties too. It's just the kid gives off an air of being very gender neutral, and you have to. I don't think it's something that you can clock unless you're looking for it, because it's like there are certain people who give off certain vibes when you meet them, and you just kind of know. And the way that the kid chooses to dress too, and the way that the kid acts is just very, it just gives off a vibe. It's like when you walk into a room and you go, oh, that person also went to the school I went to. So hard to explain, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I guess, just speaking, I don't really have like any kind of gender anything. I just say I'm female because that works. I don't really have to think about it, so I guess that means it. But I will say that since you're saying it, I think that's important, because it feels like you can relate to that, and even if it's not their intention, that it works in that way is good.
And even if there's a British TV show, and I cannot for the life of me remember the name, but my mom wanted me to watch it because they have a kid in it that presents as gender neutral, and the kid uses male pronouns, but the kid just dresses gender neutral and wears whatever the hell they want. And it's a male child, but you know, they dress as a female occasionally and wear their hair long and all this other stuff. And it's just it's a demonstration that clothing wise and hair wise and everything else, that you don't have to look a certain way. And because out of the other two siblings, this kid looks the most gender neutral too. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you think about the younger sister and you think about the older sibling, the middle sibling, this is the kid that does not look like a traditional older brother would. So that's the other one.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked about that for way too much, because we are now getting into the actual funeral
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. I thought this was interesting because this, so they've given each other vows to read. They were so close, this Klansman and Angela were so close that they wrote each other's vows, or they gave each other these secret things to read at their funeral.
Do you think that's actually true, or do you think that's just a thing
I think if she didn't know what she knows about him, she would have read it the way it's supposed to be read, and it wouldn't have been so bizarre, right? So it's like it is a song about a cowboy going off on his last roundup, right? But it's, she's not even trying to read it like a poem or anything. She's just like, get along, little doggy. Get along. Get along. Just like, oh, So you can tell me if you guys think this is different. I think they put that there so that you could see that here she's being touted out as his best friend, and she just can't do it. She can't.
Yeah, she doesn't know. She's friends at all.
She's in sharp relief. When you learn about, like I saw this and I was like, I felt that, like every Black person, probably 98% of us have felt that sharp betrayal when you find out that white person you were close with at one point or are close with is out there spouting all lives matter bullshit or whatever the fuck. Like, it's hard to readjust your perspective when you think you know someone, you're like, that's my person, like I know them, and then they aren't that person that you thought they were. It's like, I can see it just in her face. Like, she's just like, I don't know what the fuck I'm supposed to, I can't do this, right? Like, you can't even, and she's also like, did the wife know? Like, also, that's a whole thing. Like, yeah. I can't even imagine her getting into, is that a whole thing of her life has changed.
Because in the last episode, she did, like, she tried to, like, emphasize that Judd really loved her.
Mm-hmm.
So it feels like she might know.
Yeah.
And she was just trying to, like, no matter what you find out or whatever.
Mm-hmm. She left her alone in the room with the Klan outfit, though. Unless that was a setup, okay. If you're supposed to find it.
let's take a but truthfully, and you know, if she did leave her alone with that, there's always a chance that she might have wanted her to find it because there's no, for speaking as a white person, there's like, when you see Klan hoods, you're taught to just, you know, you see that, and it's like a great source of intense, not just violence, but shame. Like, the person who has one of those is just, you know, you don't want to be associated with it. You don't want to touch it. And then there are people who do, and then you're still culpable, you're still guilty, but you don't want to touch it. So she put her in there, and she's like, you know, you don't do that. But maybe she thought that it was time for the truth to come out.
Do you think that really, Carolyn? She's the former campaign manager for Keene, who we know is behind all of this.
Yeah.
And who we know is related to the Klansman.
At the end of the day, for the most part, I think we have, this reminds me just a little bit of the 2016 election, girl. Everyone, sharp relief and shock that white women fucking betrayed. Everyone was like, we got this in the bag, Hillary Clinton. And we're like, yes, ladies, let's go. And then everyone was like, shit, white women will always choose, some white women will choose white supremacy over their own gender at the detriment of their own gender. I don't think that she's innocent at all. I think she knows, and she's.
Well, I'm not saying that she's innocent, but there could be some deeper meaning that, like, if she's putting her on the path of discovering that the wife could be working against whatever's going on in the group.
This is a domino plan. There's dominoes. Somebody is.
Dominoes. There's no way she believed.
Yeah, she knew that she was gonna find it. She there's no way she believed that she fainted, and so she was supposed to find it. But I do not think that means that she feels guilty. I think that means that she's supposed to find it, and she's supposed to do things. They're setting her up.
Yeah,
But, I wonder if she's working with the lady in the preview.
Yeah. Yep. So what is going on? We haven't got that
yet. Yeah. Maybe not.
Bombing.
Okay. So,
so we get her singing, and then we get this paralleled against, you know, homeboy suiting up to, you know, do a little kamikaze action.
Somebody had to have dug that tunnel prior to that.
Oh, 100%. This was
very far. It was, but it wasn't too far. We didn't get to hear much about the hole because they had their pissing contest. But was this the vest that was being set up during American Hero Story last week?
I think
was
so.
After the death.
Caught that too. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So at first I was like, was that before the death? No, it was after the death. But the tunnel is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
They don't really show that being made at any point.
Mm-mm. So I wonder how long or when that took to get made, but I think that for sure that was like I know these are good actors, so when I can tell when a good actor is pretending to be bad at act, like they're pretending to act. Like King was like, stay back, I got this, everyone, I'm going to sacrifice myself. I'm like, oh my god.
Yeah.
And I know he's a good actor, he was on Mad Men, I love this dude. So like, I was just like, he's so good at acting that he's so bad at this right now, and I loved it was great. And I was like, this is stage 100%.
Did I tell you I think we're related? His father has the same exact name as my father. So I'm like, somewhere along the line, we came from the same town somewhere.
Oh, man.
Okay, so...
Oh, wait, I'll give my behind-the-scenes note real quick. Hold on. I think I saw them filming, like, at the end of July. I was getting my little Starbucks. And I saw them, like, setting up some kind of filming thing, because I'm in Atlanta, and, like, there's filming stuff everywhere. It's ridiculous. So I was walking through, and I saw a sign that said, like, it was, like, a piece of set or something, because it was covering up a thing I see, like, regularly that doesn't have that on there. So I was like, okay, that's for, like, a show or something. And I saw Greenwood Music Festival, and I'm like, what is that? What show could that be? So now I'm wondering if it's for this show, so in the Greenwood District of Tulsa.
That would be dope.
Yeah. But I'm, you know, it could be anything. It literally everything films down here.
Yeah.
But you can go on to the actual funerals.
We're almost done.
I was saying, like, is this how he's been fueling his political career, like from the start, like doing DOPA all the way to all of this, like weaving this whole thing to, and like it's very House of Cards-esque, but like setting up these little things based and just fueling his political career based on that. Like,
Lori did mention that she knew he had presidential ambitions. She said that back in
the right.
Everybody is on to that. I think they were talking about that in the first episode.
The news guy in the last episode, right? Mentioned, you're Keen. So you're for Keen then? And then it's like, nah, whatever. So I think, it's like kind of like the Beto moment right now, where like the senator's like getting like that hype, you know, everyone's like into him, and so he's about to make a run for president or whatever.
I thought Beto dropped out.
No, that's what I'm saying. Like, and that's why I'm paralleling him, because I'm saying maybe he might not last too long.
Do we know like how the political structure works for them? Or are we assuming?
I have no idea. Honestly, I don't know. They let a president for 30 years. Who the fuck knows at this point?
Like, do they have parties? Do they still have Senate and House?
Well,
like,
yeah, there's Democratic. There's like they specify conservative and liberalism. So I believe there is like in blue and red. So I think there's still the Democrats and the Republicans.
Yeah, the PDPedia thing was pretty clear on that. There is a lot of the same, like Snowflake, the thing on Snowflake. So some of the stuff is similar.
I have to wonder if there's a degree of. And I had a thought. It's gone. I had a thought. It's gone.
Puerto Rico is a state. Sorry.
Wait, hold on. I found my pins that I got at Comic-Con. I can count how many stars are on the flag.
Oh. Ooh.
Hold on. So
there is still like around 50, but it's going to be like a little more probably.
I'm thinking 60.
One, two, three, four, five, six, There are 65 stars.
Ah, I was close.
Oh man, what are the other ones?
There's 15 new states. I'm guessing that this in this reality, Puerto Rico probably is a state.
Yeah, dear PDPedia people, please list all the states for us on PDPedia,
please. Yeah, right.
Pins that they gave us were the phone booth, a squid, and the flag pin.
Can you take a picture of those just so?
Yeah.
For yeah. The vlog. Absolutely. I'll do that when we're done recording.
All right. Cool. All okay, right.
So now we dissolve Lori's face. So.
Lori's trigger happy. This is another gun in, and she shot the dude. And she literally said later on that she just was reckless as hell. Like she was like, oh, I didn't think that. Like, what the
they
hell, Lori?
Don't.
I kind of
that's vigilante behavior, y'all.
Because I really didn't even expect her to like even try to let Keen like walk over there. And I thought she was gonna shoot him like right away.
She was wild, yeah.
Yeah, she he should have waited for his comic timing, but yeah. But all right, so before we even do that, Angela and Lori kind of exchange a look of like, you know, what's good, you know, what was that? And it was like, whatever, it was just like, you know, kind of exasperation. And then they dissolve Lori's head into the statue of, I don't know who the statue is. So some listener can tell us what the bust in Veidt's abode is wearing his mask, but it kind of dissolves from her face into the statue wearing Veidt's mask, and we get this craziness where this throws all of our theories of what heck is going on.
I'm
Veidt.
Still married to my theory that it's like a clone Veidt, but
I'm fully dismissing that because there's no way they're setting up this Jeremy Irons for just a clone Veidt. I don't think that they're going to build that around a clone.
Well, okay, let's actually talk about the scene first.
A lot of stuff happens. Do we want to go through everything that happens, or do we just want to kind of talk about what our theories are?
Well, let's talk about what our theories are, and I'm going to kick it off by saying, since we had a DC reference at the beginning of the episode, is this a Marvel reference because he's building something made out of iron and skin question mark. But the minute I saw the iron stuff, I was like, oh, he's building Iron Man.
So I think that there is hints of that. And then before we get going, I just want to point out that the song that he plays on the phonograph is from a 1969 album. It might be 66, but it's from the 60s. It's by Desmond Dekker. And it's called The Israelites, and it's, you know, it's kind of a bit reggae, maybe, song. It was popular, it was on the radio in the 60s, you know, around the time that crime busters were doing their thing. And it's basically about this guy, and you know, of course, at the end, it sounds like somebody comes for him, maybe the police, because he says he doesn't want to end up like Bonnie and Clyde. So it does, I think the song in general is kind of Veidt feeling sorry for himself, but it's also a montage song for him doing work.
One of the things I'm going to do, I've decided watching this episode, is you guys, I'm going to go through the first three episodes, and on the blog, y'all can watch for this, I'm going to Shazam all the musical cues, all the songs, and we'll make a playlist for you.
Oh, hey, nice.
This is an interesting one.
So,
so he's doing something. He's building something.
Spin suit because he's not on Earth, y'all.
Yeah, I'm kind of feeling that as well. And we can talk about that. So he builds a suit out of, and this is the debate of, and it's going to get gross, is this Mr. Phillips' skin or is this a cow skin or something else?
The actual suit, the suit of armor?
Yeah, the suit that he's making out of
skin.
Yeah, like, he's making skin.
He made some kind of leather, yeah. And I'm going to argue it's not. If it is a Phillips skin, it's not from the Phillips from the last episode. It's from other Phillips.
Yeah, Phillips.
Because the one the last episode, the skin was too damaged. Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I'm assuming he's killed many, many of the Phillipses, so, or whoever. So, yeah, I would assume, that he's been creepily skinning clones.
It could also be other, because there was other meat in the meat locker where he was doing his thing. But regardless, he builds a suit and he like puts some glass onto a suit of armor, and it's definitely supposed to be a spacesuit. And we don't see what happens to the Phillips inside the spacesuit.
Hashtag Vite is not as smart as Iron Man. Boom.
I don't think he's trying to do what we... It didn't work out the way he wanted to, but I don't think he's trying to...
Working with limited resources. And also, hold on. I lost it. Never mind. Go ahead.
So what he wants is, I think, and you guys can tell me, I think all he wants is attention from the jailer. I think this is his version of running the cup along the bars. Whatever the game warden is, whoever is holding him here, and we can talk about who we think is holding him here. He's definitely, I feel like this is none of this. The crazy stuff he did last week was also meant to say, well, what if I tell the story of his life in this grotesque play? Won't he come? Maybe if it's Manhattan holding him, wouldn't Manhattan come and tell me you're wrong or something, or try and get his attention, right?
Is he would know that he doesn't care. Like, Manhattan literally doesn't care. But also, we also see that he's just kind of getting crazier and crazier every day of his captivity.
Okay. Sorry, I just had my mind blew. Okay, my mind blew. Everybody thinks that Manhattan doesn't care. There's arguably no person who knew him better than Lori. The end of Lori's joke is Manhattan going to hell. And she says, you know, this guy who is basically God, blah, blah, blah. And then there's a line where she says, he knows, where Manhattan tells God, he says, it doesn't matter because I know I'm going to hell already. And God says, well, how do you know that? And he says, and then she says, because he looked at him very sadly. And he said, I know I'm already in hell. So he knows that he's trapped with all of the power and everything else. And when you said that, and you guys are speculating that Manhattan is on Mars, and that Adrian Veidt is not on Earth.
Then in the very
Manhattan's on Mars. Okay, Manhattan's on Mars. Hear me out. The very first episode, you saw the castle tumble. What if Manhattan has put Veidt in a repeating little miniature universe where, and he just kills him multiple times? And I know that the dictum of the Watchmen fandom is that Manhattan doesn't give a shit. That is true. But Lori specifically points out that he has thought about it and he has tried to care. Okay?
But Veidt isn't dying.
How do you know he hasn't died already?
So here's what I'll tell you. Here's what I think is going on. I think Dr. Manhattan obviously was trying to make the castle, and that might have been an early attempt to do what becomes the prison. That makes sense to me. So he obviously made the castle once, and now the castle exists. And maybe he was trying, there was old footage, and he was trying to make a castle for Veidt. Maybe he put it somewhere else. Who knows where he put it? Prison on Earth. But I think he also made life. I think he made the people aren't quite right. And I think that Veidt points that out all the time, that the people that he made were not his Adam and Eve, which were not quite right. Right. But the buffalo, I think it's like he doesn't care about him killing the imperfect people that he made. But the buffalo maybe are perfect. And if you touch the buffalo, you know.
I honestly don't think that. If it is Dr. Manhattan holding him there, which honestly, I don't know if he is. It might be Lady True, y'all, because she bought his company.
That's
she might
also, awesome. Yep.
But I think that if Doc is doing that, I don't think he's doing this to punish him. I think he's trying to figure something out. I think he's using Veidt to figure something out, like a problem, solve a problem that he can't quite figure out. And it's I'm still thinking there's tachyons, whatever, there's obscuring his vision. There's still things going on. I think if he's holding him hostage, I don't think he's trying to punish him, because I think you're fully overestimating that. How, I just don't think he cares enough to punish him.
He
wants to use him for something if he's holding him.
Right. And it could be Lady True, and it could be Veidt has imprisoned himself. And that the whole thing is that he needed to be out of the picture for a while, and now he wants to come back. I do think he is trying to get somebody's attention. And he goes out to shoot the buffalo, and that's what gets the attention. And you gotta wonder why
the Lone Ranger, which is the second reference of the Lone Ranger. Remember, Lori called what's his face, Petey, with he had this little little mask.
Yeah, you're not the Lone Ranger.
I'm gonna give my theory, and I'm gonna tie it to that. Okay, the warden seems kind of young, or at least not. It's not like another riot, at least. So. I wonder if that's just another Mr. Phillips.
Yeah, I was thinking another Mr. Phillips, but yeah. I think it's. Oof. Let me finish.
I'm wondering if my theory is that this is like a clone Vite or something. I wonder if Vite is watching this kind of, like, you know, those, I don't know, what do they call it, with the, where you have all the ants living in like the little plastic thing.
Ant farm.
Yes. I think it's Vite looking and monitoring this, like, fake Vite and all the clones and stuff, trying to see what he might do in a different circumstance or something. Like, I feel like it's something like that.
He cloned himself, because that would mean he would have cloned himself at his own age, because that Vite is exactly his age.
Well, yeah, the clones, in order for them to all be...
They're replicated at... I'm sorry, I'm thinking of Connor Kent now. I'm like, wait a minute, they have to be... born at the little fetus part, and then they grow. I went off universe. No. It's probably a different cloning process in this universe, my bad.
I feel like it's something like that, where it's still Vite running the show, but when we're watching is not like Vite. It's like he certainly believes he's Vite, but I do think, like, I don't think it's as simple as Vite is being held captive by somebody.
Like
that,
I think so. Here's just the reason why is that he's so frustrated when he does this thing. It's obviously impressive. He either sends him up into the Earth's atmosphere so high that he gets frozen, or he sends him, or who knows, or maybe he just freeze dries. I don't know, but whatever he does, he's so upset about it. But then just getting the letter makes him so excited, he puts on his Ozymandias.
Live action comics accurate Ozzy look, yes. Looking good. Love, thank you. Anyway,
petition to have Jean Smart wear Laurie's costume from the comics.
God, oh my god, it would be amazing. And yeah, I will say that I do one of my original theories was from one of the previous episodes was that. Though the whole Dr. Manhattan is on Mars thing is basically just a line fed. It's a loop. It's something that isn't actually real. He's not actually on Mars. It's just something that they say to themselves. I think that those phone booths could possibly be just someone's intercepting those calls. It's just some people monitoring what people are sending. And if Vite is entrapping himself on Mars or wherever, he's the one who sent... taking a homeboy away and sending Angela's car back. I could see all that happening. I know that's a really weavy, wormy way to do that.
I agree with you on Hooded Justice's friends being Manhattan.
Yeah, like, I think that he's got 100%. higher powers, yeah. Or high friends. Regardless if it's my or man, yeah.
I just had a thought, since I don't know if we've completely given up going over the episode chronologically at this point. But
there's not much left. We're getting there.
There's two main scenes left. So
yeah, we have Petey. We have to talk about Lori and Angela. I mean, I'm sorry.
There's that one in the very end. So
yeah,
like,
yeah. And I haven't talked about Lady True yet, which I could save next week. But
Lady True actually debuts next week on an episode in the actual episode. Anyway, go ahead. Okay. Carolyn, you were going to say something?
No. I was going to say, let us do... Here's how we're going to wrap this up, guys. We're going to do our scenes, and we're going to let Vanessa talk about Lori and Angela, because Vanessa leads the Petey stand-em. We stand for Agent Petey and the Lori Blake fandom. So Vanessa, you're leading us with the charge on this, and then we're gonna cover the last scene, and then we're gonna do a theory roundup, which I also have some feelings about Lady True. So Vanessa, take it away with Lori.
Okay, so we have a great shot back at the funeral, or basically homeboy Keen is giving a press conference, and this is just feeding into my theory that he saves everything, because he's usually using this to fuel his political career. Lori steals poor Petey's coffee to give to Angela, and we get this amazing scene between two powerhouse women who are going to be Emmy winners because of this scene. Literally, I gift it, actually, and I'm like obsessed with it. They're talking about, you know, the kind of, you can kind of see Lori doing her usual thing, entrapping vigilantes. She does it. She did it earlier in the episode with the bank robber. She entrapped the shadow, and now she's doing it verbally with Angela. She's basically, you know, talking about discovering. I love that she called back, you know, of course I'm going to check those if there's secret compartments everywhere. My dad had a secret compartment. I fucking loved that. That was beautiful. And then she was basically just shooting all these barbs at, like, oh, were you fucking him? Of course you weren't fucking him. You have a hot husband. You know, he's not a good guy. Like she was just doing, it was so beautifully scripted. It was like one of those speeches that you see a clip of and you're like, damn, that's going to get her an award. And she goes, you know, but here's the thing about me, Sister Knight, I eat good guys for breakfast. And then we get Regina King as Angela Barr mockingly going, ooh, pouring out the coffee and walking away. And Lori's like, what the fuck just happened? And I don't think she has had a handle on every single person she's come across in this episode. She's immediately figured out, handle on, and gotten through and just gotten the shit done, got her way. This is the first time we've seen Lori being like, what the fuck? And
oh,
I
gosh.
Loved that. This is setting up such a beautiful and interesting dynamic where they're at odds, but they're eventually, like what Carolyn said earlier, they're going to eventually work together. And I'm so, that was so beautifully
crafted. Well, superheroes, as they say. They all fight, and then they all team up.
It's like Batman versus Superman. But no, no, I love that scene, and I just had to talk about it because, and I know if you guys have anything else to say about it, but it was so good, and it really shows that these two women fully believe what they believe, and they're on two opposite sides right now, but I know that they'll come together eventually.
See, that her popping her head out of the hole was maybe a big jump scare for me, but she looked very Night Owl when she did it, didn't she?
Yes. And then Lori at the end, when they ended that scene, was framed by the glasses. They like, she was appeared right behind the glasses that were just sitting there because Angela left them behind. Whew, y'all, I ship it.
Love it. Love it, love it, love it. Now, then Lori goes back to the hotel. And I believe, Tony, you had something that you wanted to say.
Well, I said I didn't want to say it. We could be on this part for a little while. Okay, so she goes back to the room. I do want to mention that Petey was in room 238. I don't know if that number is significant.
Oh, that's it. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, she goes back to the room. We finally figured out what's in that case. the first thing that's in there is, like, when, like, it's kind of like a Tijuana Bible kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that, too.
And, of course, the other thing that's in there, the big thing that we're going to talk about now, is
dildo!
Coming soon from HBO Prop Replicas.
Y'all, I was like, I'm sorry. I was watching this with my husband, Amy, and I looked at each other like, oh, that's what that is. Okay.
Wait, is this a balloon animal? It
looks like a Jeffrey Koons balloon animal art piece. Holy shit, it was huge. She is.
Okay. So, like, we can accept that. Like, okay, fine. She has that. And but she kind of, okay. And I guess right now she's going to talk about what happened in the scene. So she puts it down, and I don't think she brings it with her, but I guess you could debate that. But she ends up going to Petey's room and, like, seducing him. Yeah, or however you want to put it.
How Lori got her groove back.
Yeah. And then after that, Petey's room, like,
oh, God.
the Rorschach thing in there, like the book, the journal, or a publisher nightstand, which is probably significant. Or I mean, it could just be him being a nerd, but I was like, you know.
And also, what do we think that she fucked him or banged him for? I don't know why I censored myself, but whatever. I already said it. Like, because she's trying to get closer. Maybe she's suspicious of his Rorschach.
I'll give you my theory. You can tell me I'm totally wrong. I think it was very clearly she brought him because he reminded her of, she doesn't need him. She has zero need for him. She brought him because she had to bring somebody, and he reminds her of young Dan, and she might want a piece of that. And I think that was it. She chooses every night. You saw it in the first scene. She chooses every night of, you know, she feeds, you know, the Dan allegory, and then she's got John in her case. So I mean,
that makes sense because he's wearing a mask, and it's famous that Dan Draper cannot get it up unless he's wearing the Owlman costume.
Yeah. I also do agree with that, but I also think it's another layer of she's specifically fucking a younger dude. She was got into a relationship with Doc at a very young age. It's a kind of a cycle, like, of layered on top of that. I think it was both. I think both were layered on top of that. Both of her relationships were layered on top of that scene. And but she's also, I think,
we all do eventually.
And and her dad.
And her dad. God,
become our parents.
At least you can't physically knock anyone up and do anything awful to them. So that's God. Oh, that legacy. And now, anyway.
I want us to spend a little bit of time on this. The meta where, what's his name? David Lindelof. I can't pronounce the last
name. Damon Lindelof. What? Nope. I can't do it either.
Okay. So basically, I don't have it pulled up right now. Sorry. But basically, he said that scene of what's in the case is because it was another one of the creators on the show, I can't remember the name, I think it was like Lita or Leela something, they she came up with it, and she, like, it was just supposed to be like a gag, like, oh well, she'd have blue dildo in there, and so I guess the writers kind of like really like, oh, okay, that's funny, but it's like actually right around it, so they made it kind of, to me, I think, unnecessary. But they basically, from Damon's perspective and all that, it is like he was saying, oh well, he thinks his interpretation of this Laurie is a Laurie who is still stuck on Manhattan. And I didn't really like that, because to me, I would think, okay, she was just too, I find that it's almost a divide between like what he said in the interview, or I think it may have been the official podcast, and what was shown in the episode. Because in the episode, to me, it's framed as a very, maybe she's kind of nostalgic, maybe she's kind of just thinking of the old days and thinking about her life and all that, but it didn't seem like she was really hung up on anyone.
She does call him,
she calls him a lot. She's a platinum member. Been together a long time, like 20 years.
I mean, she at a very young age, like, that's a big, I understand, and I do believe that she could be deeply still in love with him, and not, I mean, I don't know about hung up, but like, it's hard for you to shake that, you know, she was involved with him at a very young age for a long, long time.
You guys just made me think of something though that probably puts a really dark spin on this.
Go ahead.
Okay, so we've discussed the idea that Veidt is being held captive somewhere, and we've also flirted with the idea, and it was Vanessa, and then Tony kind of backed her up on it, that the characters are being fed the line with Manhattan on Mars, because it's always everybody's excuse, Manhattan's on Mars, Manhattan's on Mars, Manhattan's on Mars, Manhattan's on Mars. What if this reality that we are seeing is Manhattan watching and trying to do what he remembers with all of these people? Because people automatically assume that not giving a shit doesn't mean that not giving a shit means completely not acknowledging somebody at all. And that's often not the case. I mean, Manhattan is just, he really doesn't care, but that doesn't mean that he's not still a very vain creature.
Yeah, so, and curious too, in a way.
Yeah. So what if her infatuation, and I, to be perfectly frank, I think I'm going to get jost on this because the theory is so, because it would make a lot of sense and it would be a really cool twist, but it strikes me that as cool as Damon Lindelof has been with this show, that he would really misconstrue Laurie about that, because Laurie really did find something with Dan. And yeah, she did have stuff with Manhattan, but it really did strike me as she just genuinely became very scared of him, especially towards the end of the comic where she's on Mars and he brings her up there and he's the reason that, like, she can breathe on Mars. That's the kind of thing that would mess with your head.
That, yeah, like, it's too much power.
But that doesn't mean it goes away. I mean, that doesn't mean she stops thinking about it. It's a long time of her life.
It is a long time of her life, but to the point where you can't let it go, even though you had somebody.
But is that really it?
Yeah, you can be in love with two people at once.
Or is it that she still gets off on him? I mean, it's still her fantasy. It doesn't mean it's like she didn't move on or she somehow damaged.
Yeah, also that. There's also like you can idealize, especially not seeing someone for 30 years, you can idealize a version of them in your head. Yep. Like, there's probably like there's a good chance that she's purposely not remembering the bad parts that she didn't like about their relationship. When you're missing someone, or you feel like you're in that place, or you're darker, you're lonely, you're isolated, the bad parts fall away very quickly.
Like her mom said.
Yeah, that's literally, literally, that's exactly why. And that's, I mean, it could be parallel to, you know, her mom going back to the comedian after he literally tried to rape her. Like, it's, you fall back into bad patterns, not for any logical reason. That's just human nature, you know?
So that theory makes sense. And I'm going to go with that theory being the actual theory. So you guys, if anybody's listening and you hear that, then that's the theory that I'm going with. But the theory I'm going to postulate to make this more interesting is, what if Manhattan has put all of these people in a bubble and is watching what they do? Because that just strikes me as the kind of thing that somebody with absolute power would do. And it was like, okay, well, if you can raise people's emotions to certain things and you can do things with them, then why wouldn't you sit there and want adoration and praise? You need every... And we're getting into the theological discussions again with this, but the constant references to godhood and everything else in this, like, you eventually you're going to realize that people are going to praise you, and it's like, you know, what do you do with it? So I don't think I'm right, but I want to put it out there just in case I could be right, that this all could be Manhattan making people. And this was what he went off and he was like, yes, I'm going to create something. I'm going to go and I'm going to go into an alternate reality and I'm going to become Damon Lindelof. And I'm going to first do a Lost TV show, and then I'll do another HBO show, and then I'll do this show. And then one day when the show ends, I'll turn into a giant blue naked being way into the distance. I don't know. But I just, I'm going to put that theory out there. And you know what? I'm prepared 150% to be wrong, because it makes more sense in terms of Watchmen that your guys' theory is correct. But still, you know, if it really is meant to be a one-and-done series, then this is always possible. So, yeah, that's my theory.
So she comes out of the booth. Are we there yet?
Oh, yes.
So she comes out of the booth, and she's just kind of like, he's not listening, and I just wasted my money again, and da-da-da-da. When a car falls from probably the same sky hook that picked the car up.
Yeah, that was her car.
And I think we know she went to the crime scene and that she saw both. Let's be honest, she saw both sets of tire tracks at least, and probably a bunch of other police cruisers. But I think this shouldn't be a big stretch. Like, this seemed like a present here. You can match these tire tracks. And it did feel like a present. And she looks up and she sees Mars. I don't think this was came. The car obviously didn't go to Mars and come back. But
well, I mean, it could have.
Elon Musk, is that you?
Gosh.
Yeah, I have a couple of different theories about where the car came from. It could have been from somewhere really high up in like a airship or whatever, really high up from like True Industries or whatever. Or it could have literally came from Mars. But cars burn on reentry. Like, we also have to think about science here, folks. Like, a car coming from Mars is not going to survive. Like, that's insane.
Manhattan has atomic level control.
That's if we're, true. If we're assuming it was Manhattan,
zapped it away to Mars, zapped it back. It's possible.
But like, why wouldn't he just, but that's rude as fuck. Why wouldn't he zap it back in proper condition? And also, why would he need a little plunger thing to get it in the first place? That's why I don't think it was Manhattan. So
yeah. No, I think that's a fake out, but I think.
She obviously saw.
She took it.
It's like, my prayers have been answered. Yeah.
Basically, like, it really was like confessional. Whoever mentioned, I forgot who mentioned confessional earlier, but it was like confessional. She's like, you're never going to hear my prayers. And then she gets a literal sign. Like, it was basically like burning bush. Like, all the biblical like references were there.
Here's that brick that girl.
Here's the brick. Yep. Mm-hmm. Tied it back to the brick. Yeah, absolutely.
But it was, oh my gosh, I didn't even think about that. It was like an answer to the brick joke. It was like,
that's what I originally.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even think about that.
That's why it was good. That was a good ending.
That's why she was like, that's why she started laughing. I was like, oh, she's like, I get the joke. That was good.
Snare drum curtains. But I'm,
yes, and that reference, the reference to Rorschach's joke was really good too.
The reference to Pagliacci.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Guys, go back and listen to the previous episodes. Okay, so.
Yeah, you can do that.
We're going to talk about next week a little bit about.
Yeah.
Can I tell you my little Lady True bit of before we start about actual Lady True in the show? So,
hit me.
This is not her real name. Lady True is her Ozymandias name. So obviously Adrian took the Ozymandias name off of a Shelley poem about Ramses II. This Lady True is a Vietnamese folk hero, thought to be an actual person from I think like the 2nd or 3rd century. She's kind of like a Boudicca or a King Arthur kind of style figure from kind of, you know, Celtic lore, in that, you know, whereas, you know, King Arthur and Boudicca fought off the Roman invasions in England. Lady True rallied together an army to fight off the Chinese invasion of Vietnam. And she was pretty incredible. And it just, so it was kind of like what Laurie says. We started off the episode by talking about, you know, what Laurie said to Dan, you know, as they were walking away about how she didn't want to change diapers. But let me come back up here. The big quote of Lady True is, she says, and this is obviously a translation and it's been translated differently in other places. So this is just the one I picked up. I want to ride the storm, to tread the dangerous waves, to win back the fatherland and destroy the yoke of slavery. I don't want to bow down my head working as a simple housewife. And she's pretty impressive. I mean, like, there's legends that she was like super tall, and like this, one of the weird things is like she has 3-foot long boobs, which is like, I don't know, it doesn't make any sense, but they're really impressed with that. you can see that in some of the artwork. Some of the artwork they show her in this beautiful golden armor, and some art she has 3-foot long boobs. But she is a legendary figure, and I feel like this is supposed to be kind of like her Ozymandias name. So we'll see how Vite-like she is. Obviously, she's the head of Vite's company, and she's probably executing a plan, knowingly or unknowingly, you know, that is in line with what Vite wanted, and has something to do with the Millennium Clock and probably collecting everybody's DNA. maybe those DNA samples are for Dr. Manhattan's people. So that piece of information was very interesting, and maybe next week we could talk a little bit more about it. But she is a pretty big mythological type figure, historical/mythological type figure from Vietnam.
Wow.
Which is also where Angela Abar grew up.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Is probably genetically related in some line.
That's really cool. That is a really, really cool fact. Okay, so what do we want to do? We want to close out with our what we hope to see in the next episode? Or shall we talk about the trailer, or what do we want to do?
Yeah, I mean, basically.
Okay. So what do we want to see in the next episode?
I'm most excited to see, I think we see Angela presenting or showing Wade Looking Glass, Judd's secret Klansman uniform. And so I'm excited to see that, and how, honestly, I really want to see how Wade responds to just blatant, direct, iconic, like racist iconicism, and and just really, I just really want to kind of deep and hope that actually gives us like an insight into him as a person. And I also obviously want to see more Lori, Angela, stuff when we get it, because like we obviously have a team upcoming soon with Lady True, where they explore wherever the hell they're at. So I'm excited for all that, and I hope to see. Yeah, I just want to see more of Wade.
Yay!
Okay.
Yeah, I'll go. Oh well, I want to see more Petey, because I'm not convinced. I think he might be evil, but like I feel like I want to know if he is or not before I start liking him, because I don't know, that's just how I am. And like him and Panda are like, both of them, I'm worried about them, but like I like them kind of. And I guess it's kind of like I'm not sure where they're about to go with everything beyond that, because it's hard to really predict all the Lady True stuff. Like, okay, she's gonna look at the family tree thing, but I don't know. So I guess interested in what they're about to unfold, because it feels kind of big. Like, we can't even really guess what's about to happen.
Truth facts. Okay, Wendy.
We still don't know what was in the Christmas present, and this is gonna drive me nuts.
Oh yeah,
oh, no. Say,
right.
It's gotta be important now. But yeah, no, I feel betrayed that we didn't see that. But no, of course I want to know what's going on with Lady True, and I think she's the big factor that we don't know here. Is she a cog in Adrian's machine? Is she a cog in somebody else's machine? Or is she the puppeteer? We don't know.
And if as Wendy suggested, Vite's weird machinations, because again, you guys remember I'm showing this to my coworker who has never read any other Watchmen material. So I sat her down, we're watching the first episode, and she looks at me when Jeremy Irons is getting his rub down, and she says, is she just rubbing his thighs? And I was like, yeah. And she goes, why just his thighs? And it kind of drove home to me that the stuff he's been doing has been weirder and weirder and weirder.
Weird, yeah.
And at this point, we'll be four episodes in by next week. I need to know what he's doing. If he's just losing his mind, or going full Robinson Crusoe, or going full Tom Hanks in Castaway, and all of the clones are his Wilson Beach Ball. I don't know, but I need to know what's going on with that, because at this point, I'm just gonna sit there and go, okay, Jeremy Irons was in Borges and he was in a bunch of Disney movies. Like, there's so much more that you could be doing than having him running around being ridiculous. I mean, it's hilarious, yeah. But like, I need to know what's going on with him.
Mm-hmm.
So, what's the title for the fourth episode?
I don't know if we have it. Let me see. Little Fear. Wait, no. If you don't like my story, write your own. Reclusive trillionaire Lady True finally enters the stage with a mysterious offer, with Blake getting closer to the truth of her cover-up. Angela enlists Looking Glass for help. The Lord trains two new servants.
Interesting.
Oh, if you don't like my story, write your own. Well,
oh, sorry. I'm thinking new servants. So clones of different people?
We don't know. It could be just another two.
No, I think it's just two new, like two ones that aren't. Or
okay,
maybe.
See, I feel like if these are Manhattan's fake people, and they all look the same, in the buffaloes, you could make one male and one female buffalo, and you really wouldn't know. Like, you looking at the buffaloes, would you know that they're exactly the same buffaloes? but they definitely don't feel like they feel like. I mean, remember, he said they're incapable of disloyalty, and they're incapable, mm-hmm. and things don't occur to them. And it's just like, you feel like maybe they're not. It's not like they're organic people with free will. They're kind of
they're automaton a little bit.
Yeah. So I don't know. There is a little bit of fear, but is that us projecting?
Who are they clones of? I mean, are they just randomly generated people, or
they could? They... Yeah, right. We're using clones, but we don't know if they're clones or not.
Yeah, we have no idea, but we know they're identical to each other. What I read in the IMDb is that the actress also plays Marionette, but that doesn't mean Marionette isn't a clone. So I don't think we know. We're not supposed to know at this point.
This show is getting so deep, and it is amazing.
Well, that's all for tonight. But if you'd like to contact Watchmen Podcast, you can email us at watchmentvpodcast@gmail.com. You can post a comment on our website, watchmenpodcast.com. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, you can call us at 918-200-9103. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram at Watchmen Podcast. On Twitter, you can follow us at Watchmen Talk. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Stitcher Radio. We always love it when you give us a rating and review. Watchmen Podcast is part of the DCTV Podcast Network. So if you're interested in other DC shows, you can check out Batwoman Podcast, Black Lightning Podcast, DCTV Classics, DC's Legends of Tomorrow Podcast, iZombie Radio, Krypton Podcast, Stargirl Podcast, Supergirl Radio, Swamp Thing Radio, The Flash Podcast. You can subscribe to DCTV Podcasts on Apple Podcasts and follow DCTV Podcasts on Twitter and like DCTV Podcasts on Facebook. Until next time, tick-tock, tick-tock.